This is the Wheeler Center podcast.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sisonkem Semang, and I will be moderating this glittering conversation. Before we begin, I would like to respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Boon Wurrung and the Wurjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respects to the elders past, present, and future. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Whenever I say this, of course, I am unsettled by the words that I am saying, because at a moral and spiritual level, it is certainly the case this always was and always will be Aboriginal land. And at a political and practical level, we also live in a country with the highest incarceration rates, a country that criminalizes Aboriginal people simply for existing. And so I find myself unsettled whenever I say these words. And in some ways, this feeling of being unsettled is an important way for us to think about how we frame and begin this conversation with two women who are in the business of unsettling us, of making us feel uncomfortable. Part of what is hopeful and interesting and important about insisting that this will be, always will be, Aboriginal land is that it contains within it an aspiration, a sense that what the future holds is an Australia in which this may once again not just morally and spiritually be Aboriginal land, but can be a place in which we all claim that we live in a place that is genuinely Aboriginal land. And so this sense of hope, unsettledness, fight back resistance is very much embodies the spirit of the two women with whom I sit today. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome them both. Fatima Bhutto. Fatima Bhutto was born in Kabul, Afghanistan. She grew up in Syria and Pakistan. She is the author of 6 books of fiction and nonfiction she does not play. Her debut novel, The Shadow of the Crescent Moon, was longlisted for the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction. Songs of Blood and Sword, the extraordinary memoir that she wrote about the life of an assassination of her father, was published to great acclaim. Her most recent book, which you must read, is New Kings of the World. It's a look at the forces that are challenging America's cultural dominance of the world. Her work has appeared in New Statesman, Daily Beast, Guardian, The Caravan magazine. She lives and writes in Karachi, Pakistan. Welcome, Fatima. No voice coming out of the Arab Spring was as urgent and essential as Mona El-Tahawi's. Her new book, The 7 Necessary Sins for Women and Girls, is an incendiary, I think that's an appropriate word, call to arms from a journalist defined by her wit and her power. She's also the author of Headscarves and Hymens, Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution, and is a contributor to the New York Times opinion pages. Her commentaries have appeared in several other publications, and she's a regular guest an analyst on various television and radio shows, including our very own ABC's Q&A. Welcome, Mona. So I think you will all be very pleased that you are here on a Sunday morning, so bright and early, to have this conversation. The title of this session is Necessary Truths. And I wanted to frame the conversation as one that is about speaking truth to power, and that is about what it means to speak out, what it means to be courageous, and what it means to be brave. And as I was thinking about how we begin to have this conversation, a few years ago, I was asked to speak to a group of women in South Africa, and they asked me to speak about courage. And so I gave this talk, and it was a very feminist talk about all the women in South Africa's history who had shown great courage. And a young woman walked up to me, and I was feeling very happy with myself for filling in the blanks of feminist history that so many young people don't know. And afterwards, a young woman came up to me, and she said, you know, that was really interesting, Miss Sisonke, because I am of the age where people call me Miss Sisonke. And she said, but I still don't know how you be brave. What is the how? And so I want us to frame a conversation that is both about big picture, speaking truth to power, but also that gets us into the nitty-gritties of the how. And in order to do that, we're going to have a bit of a deep dive, not just into ideas, but into who you both are. So I'm going to start way back. I want to go a little bit back, and I want you to both talk to me about where and how you grew up, because I want to begin to frame how you got this way. And so I want to understand from both of you. I know you've both lived in multiple places, but let's start with you, Fatima. Where did you grow up and how? What did that house, those houses look like?
Well, I was born in Afghanistan because my father was in exile. His father, who was Pakistan's first democratically elected head of state, had been overthrown by a CIA-backed dictator, General Ziaul-Haq, who was essentially empowered to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan at that time. And he brutalized the Pakistan of my father's generation. So this young country at that time, which was just over 30 years old, its imagination was cut short. Not only did you have a dictatorship, but it sought power over everybody and over everything. So this was a period in which journalists were whipped in stadiums. They were publicly flogged. This was a time when amputation was prescribed as the punishment for theft. General Zia couldn't find a single doctor in all of Pakistan to carry out an amputation, so the dictatorship then approached butchers. Remarkably, they couldn't find a single butcher who would do it either. And he also put into laws things like the Hudud ordinances, which effectively criminalize the victims of rape because they make adultery and premarital sex crimes punishable by stoning to death. So if you're a woman and you've been raped and you're married, you've just committed adultery, which they can prove because of medical evidence. You can't prove that a man is a rapist. And if you're single, then you've just committed premarital sex. And it was a terrifying time. And I was born three years after my grandfather had been executed, but 5 years after the coup. And from Kabul, we went to Syria, which, of course, was not the Syria you see in the news today in some respects. And I had a quiet childhood there. Syria actually, compared to Pakistan, was a place of calm for a brief period. And we returned back to Pakistan in 1993 when I was 11 years old. My father made the decision after 16 years to go home to fight an election and to return to his country. And I grew up, as exiles do, always with this home, this idea of home hovering over my head, and my father always saying, we will go back, we will go. And I never believed him, I just thought we'll never go back, so I wasn't that bothered. And then we did go back. And this violence that I had always encountered from afar, sheltered by distance, became very close then. And my father was killed outside of our home 2 years after our return. So the idea of violence for me has never been abstract, it's never been theoretical, it's always been, if not at the doorstep, then much closer. And I think to go to your question, Sisonke, of how to be brave, I think what my country has taught me, which I'm grateful to it for, is that courage doesn't flower in the face of fearlessness. There's no such thing as fearlessness. I wonder if Mona will agree, but I don't believe in the idea of fearlessness. I am afraid often. But you are brave because you continue.
You are brave because you continue, which I think it's absolutely the case. Did you feel safe as a child in your home? So inside the walls, inside the doorstep?
Well, no, actually, not really. My uncle was killed when I was 3 years old, and he was killed inside his home. Mm. So the idea of the state and where the state could reach was always very clear to me. It could reach you anywhere. And there were certain things, there's certain things you can do to protect yourself. I mean, if you're a woman and you're traveling alone, you know all the rules, you know how to be alert, you know how to be aware. But if what you're trying to guard against is the state, then there's nothing you can do.
Particularly when the state has such absolute power.
The state always has absolute power. Every state has absolute power. And I think it's a luxury to imagine that the state doesn't have an absolute power or that it cannot reach you. I think one of the interesting things about the past few years is people waking up to this fact. Mm. You know, as countries practice renditions, as the news becomes more easily accessible, we know that all states are like this. You know, the idea of an innocent state doesn't exist. Mm. We are innocent as people, but we shouldn't be.
Mm. Thanks, Fatima. Mona, what was the, so you too traveled to many places and you had a childhood, if not of exile, certainly a childhood in many places.
Yes. I just want to start by saying good morning, everyone, and I'm wearing sequins because this is my way of saying fuck the patriarchy. And
first fuck of the morning,
yes.
For some.
It is the dress that I will wear when I'm dancing on the grave of misogyny and patriarchy, especially here in Australia, which you have plenty of. So thank you. I will get to your question now, Sasanke. Because you might be wondering why the fuck I look like I'm going to a wedding on Sunday morning, but now you know. So we were also moving a lot when I was a child for very different reasons, not because of political reasons or for exile, but because of my parents' education and work. So I was born in Egypt, and when I was 7, my family moved to the UK because my parents got a scholarship to study medicine. And if I were like to trace all the things that had taught me to be brave or had made me who I am, it would be like this in a very kind of like short timeline, because I've given it a lot of thought. So very soon after we moved to the UK, my white female teachers, this is 1975 now, at the height of second wave feminism, so they should have known better, were always asking me, so Mona, what does your dad do? As if all my mom did was just follow him around the world. And I would say, and I didn't understand what was at play at the time, because I was like 7, 8, 9, whatever. And I would say very proudly and very indignantly, you know, my mother and my father are doctors, and they both brought us to London. And I realize now in looking back that they kept asking me this because even though these were women who themselves were working outside of the home, they did not imagine that an Egyptian Muslim woman would also be working outside of the home in 1975, working on her PhD in medicine. So I look back now at that kind of racism and white misogyny, and white women are also internalizing patriarchy. I call women who internalize patriarchy, foot soldiers of the patriarchy. And so I had all these white women working outside the home, not imagining that for my mother. So that was from 1975 to 1982. In 1982, my parents moved us to Saudi Arabia, where they both got jobs, because they couldn't stay in the UK anymore, because after my father finished his PhD, he couldn't find work. It was Thatcher UK, so the recession was kicking in. My mum had a job, which perfectly took care of all of us, and my dad would drop us off at school, have dinner ready at home. When my mum came back from work, we were happy, but the Thatcher government was not, because they insisted that the father was the head of the household, and we couldn't get residency unless my dad had a job. So we moved to Saudi Arabia, white supremacist patriarchy. So we moved to Saudi Arabia and my world turns upside down. Because, so I talked about that kind of hidden misogyny and internalizing of patriarchy in the UK. In Saudi Arabia, it was in your face. My parents loved their jobs there, but I fell into a deep, deep depression. And I was traumatized into feminism. That's the only way to say it. I was traumatized into feminism. And at the age of 19, I discovered feminist texts at the university library, because I attended university in Jeddah. And those texts terrified the fuck out of me. And it was exactly why I knew that's what I needed. Because it was feminism written by women from my own cultural and faith background. The Egyptian feminist Nawal Saadawi, the Moroccan sociologist feminist Fatima Mernissi. I would go to the library, read these books, put them down, and run away. And every day I would go back. And so that was like pulling the string of courage, you know? It was just unraveling me in a really necessary way. So that was from 82 to 86. And I wanted to be a journalist, and I couldn't be a journalist in Saudi Arabia because that wasn't an option for female students there. The universities are segregated. So I moved back to Cairo to study journalism and to become a journalist. And then the challenge in Egypt then was to learn how to be Egyptian, because we left when I was 7 and I went back when I was 21. So how do I become an Egyptian? So I basically had to kind of like stitch it together for myself. And that was the challenge there. But it was also a very early lesson in the brutality of the Mubarak regime at the time, because one of the earlier stories I covered was the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights had a conference and they invited me to go and cover it as this young journalist. And I interviewed this woman who was in her 60s, who'd come from a village in Egypt to Cairo, because her friends in the village said to her, you need to go to this organization for human rights because they're going to take care of you. Because she ran a kiosk, one of those soda stands in her village, and the police came and took her to the police station and said to her, you need to testify against this man who's a car thief. And she said, no, I'm not. I don't know this guy. I've never seen him do anything wrong. And they sodomized her with the leg of a chair. I'm sorry to trigger anyone in the room, but this is the necessary horror that we need to look at, because this was a regime that was supported by 5 successive US administrations, and that we fought really hard to topple. We just got rid of Mubarak, but the rest of the fuckers are still in power and still supported by fascist fuck Donald Trump. So that was a lesson. This woman had nothing. She's this woman in her 60s from a village in Egypt who believed that she deserved justice. So that was a very early lesson in bravery. And then I moved to the US. I moved to Jerusalem in my 30s, and there I learned all kinds of lessons. And I was a journalist with Reuters there. And then I moved to the US in 2000, and now what's happening in the US? Fuck, I could write 10 books. But anyway, but I don't wake up in the morning, Sosonke, and say, how am I going to be brave today? I agree with you, Fatima. No one is fearless. What I wake up in the morning with is a lot of justifiable anger and a belief that I too deserve justice and that I demand to be free.
So thank you. Thank you both for that. So part of drilling down into the mechanics of this idea of courage is, as both of you say, is recognizing that you just don't wake up and put courage on like a glittery dress. And what's evident from, you know, both of your responses is this way in which you're always operating and thinking about a series of global forces, how global forces are structuring your lives, how you're thinking about the state, and also at the same time thinking about what it means to be a woman because you're experiencing all of these things. So it's operating at a number of really complex levels, which I think is a way in which feminism operates in contexts where people don't have a lot of money, where inequality thrives. So very different contexts from this one. And I think there's a lot for Australians to learn from this way of thinking about complexity. So I want you to both tell me about when you first experimented with being difficult. What was your first experiment with being a difficult child, woman, person, where you, and it doesn't have to necessarily have been framed in feminist terms, but when were you first aware that you might be difficult?
I think I was always difficult. I think I was always difficult. I was raised by my father as a single father for the first half of my life. And he encouraged me to be as difficult as I needed to be.
What does that look like? What did that look like as a child?
I mean, on a very small sort of micro level, I remember being a kid and being in a car. And my father remarried when I was 8 or something like that. And the woman he would marry, I remember, was in the car with her friend. And they were talking to each other. And me and my friend were in the back of the car. And my friend said something. And this woman turned around and said, shut up, to my friend. And I remember saying, and again, such a small example, I remember saying, you can't talk to my friend that way. And I got the, don't you, you're a child. And I wasn't raised to be a child. I wasn't raised to be a girl. I was just raised to say what I thought. So I remember saying, well, that doesn't matter that I'm a child. I don't know you.
Yeah.
You know, why are you telling my friend to shut up? And I knew I wasn't going to get in trouble for it, which I don't know if that helped or hurt or what it did, but I think there was the idea that you had to survive, and to survive, you had to speak, and that speaking was going to be encouraged, whatever it was. On the other hand, I was never sheltered like a child, so I was never allowed the kind of distance. So you can't do that to a child and then say, okay, stay in your lane,
right,
or whatever the expression
that's
is.
Right.
So I was always difficult. And I think, but that's good. Why is difficult bad?
There's absolutely no implication from my side that difficult is bad.
Yeah, no. I think it happens. I meet young girls who will say things like, how do we do this without? Well, you know, there's this impetus to be polite. You know, what is the value of polite if you're trying to survive? If, as Audre Lorde said, your silence will not protect you, what is then the value of silence? I mean, I'm kind of impressed and shocked that Nawal al-Saadawi is not banned in Saudi Arabia.
It was some renegade
librarian
who had this kind of secret feminist stash. I know, I can't believe it either.
Shocked.
It was feminist journals. There is no gender and women's studies department in the university.
Yeah. I mean, now that this is out there, they're going to probably go through the library shelves and pull her out. But I think women should be encouraged to be as difficult as possible all the time.
And I think, absolutely. And I think this idea... I think this idea of trying to look for a way to make change or to do things without being difficult is really impossible.
I think
it's
impossible.
So that's the first lesson in courage.
I often wonder if my family hadn't moved to Saudi Arabia, what kind of woman I would be. And I've got that kind of, you know, that film Sliding Doors. And I've got this kind of sliding doors kind of scenario playing in my head, because I think often, if we'd stayed in the UK, I would have probably been a doctor, just like my parents. I would probably have married someone from a very similar background, and I probably would have had children. I'm very happily child-free by choice. I was married disastrously for 2 years, worst fucking mistake of my life, will never be repeated. And, and now I'm as queer as fuck, so there's like, I'm turning up like polyamorous, queer, everything. So that would not have happened if we hadn't gone to Saudi Arabia, so thank you, Saudi Arabia. I'm sure Mohammed bin Salman, another fascist fuck, will appreciate my thanks. I was such a happy, polite, always smiling little girl. I had no reason to, except now that when I look back at all these teachers constantly asking me, what does your dad do? It might have developed along the way, but it took the shock of moving to Saudi Arabia to have patriarchy in my face. But I have to talk about this because I had buried it for such a long time, and it's become a central part of what I do now, and I've included in my new book. Very soon after my family moved to Saudi Arabia, we went on Hajj, which is the fifth pillar of Islam. It was like 3 weeks. 3 weeks after we landed in Jeddah, we went to Mecca, which is Islam's holiest site in Jeddah. It was the first time in my life that I was wearing what we call hijab. You could only see my face and my hands. And the sense of awe and reverence of going to the holiest site of Islam and seeing the Kaaba, which is that cubical structure that's on the walls of almost every Muslim home around the world. And, you know, we're performing the rituals of the Hajj, and I was sexually assaulted twice. At the holiest site of my religion, at the age of 15. And I did not realize at the time, it's kind of like with the teachers, because this is all happening in hindsight now, how much that broke me. I did not appreciate it, because the first time was by a man behind me who seemed to be a fellow pilgrim, and the second time was by a Saudi policeman. I burst into tears and I froze, perfectly normal reactions, and I buried it so, so deep, I did not tell anyone. And very soon after, I began to wear hijab because I just wanted to hide. I wanted to hide my body from men's hands. And I know that this is it's a very common thing by women across the world. Now, I'm not saying this is specific to Muslims. If there's any racist, Islamophobic fucks out there who want to use my words, just fuck off. This is about sexual violence, and this is about what it does to our bodies and how we're victim-shamed into hiding and into silence. So I think this is what broke the obedience and the politeness and the niceness in me. Because it doesn't matter how nice you are, it doesn't matter how much you smile, the fuckers will still get you. It does not matter. So I think that was like the beginning of the end for me. But for me, it was the beginning by being very, very kind of overtly political. My friends in high school at the time in Jeddah remember me as someone who was constantly going on about South Africa and apartheid and Northern Ireland and pay attention to this. But it was out there, yeah? It took me a long time to bring it into here. That, I think, is what the journey of courage that we're talking about is, what brought it into here so that I stopped being polite and I stopped being nice.
Mm. Fatima, you wrote this piece, I remember it so well. It was, I think it was at some point last year when Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie interviewed Hillary Clinton. And it was, as always, when you write, there is multiple layers of complexity. So you're never doing just one thing. But one of the things that was especially powerful was who you chose to take aim at. And so it's a piece in which Fatima talks about the fact that Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who is well known to many of you as a really prominent, you know, African woman writer, it was about her seduction with celebrity. And she interviews Hillary Clinton and she asks her all these fluffy, soft, you know, ridiculous questions. And she essentially fangirls her. And one day we will have another conversation about fangirling because I think it's so problematic. But part of what I appreciated about that essay was that you took aim at an unusual subject, because it's really easy to point fingers at Trump, and it's often not so easy to point a finger at another feminist, at a writer, at an African woman writer. So talk to me a little bit about the kind of courage that's necessary to take aim at a few unusual suspects.
Well, I didn't want to write that piece. I mean, most writers want to write the things they write. I didn't want to write that because I love Chimamanda's fiction. I loved Americana. I mean, for years I've been going on about how that's just one of my favorite books. I loved Half of a Yellow Sun. There's nothing she's written in the world of fiction that I don't like. And I really respect her as a writer. But I watched her interviewing Hillary Clinton at Penn, New York, I think it was. And I remember watching it on YouTube on my computer because I wanted to see Chimamanda question Hillary. And I think this idea that we're supposed to like Hillary Clinton because she's a woman, I find that that's insulting. It insults my intelligence, not just as a woman, but as a person. I mean, somebody's gender isn't interesting to me. And, you know, just to recap, Hillary Clinton, I mean, has yet to meet a war she didn't like. She voted for the Iraq War. I mean, unapologetically, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely.
If she apologized
triumphantly.
For that, I missed it, if she apologized for voting for the Iraq War. The Afghan War. Hillary Clinton was the face, really, of, you know, Obama's drone program, wherein thousands of people were killed in Pakistan and Afghanistan without trial, without any investigation into their supposed crimes. Whatever you think of Muammar Gaddafi, when he was killed in Libya, and he was, again, sorry to bring this up so early in the morning, and sorry to trigger anyone, but he was not only tortured before he was killed, but he was sodomized with a sword. When Hillary Clinton was asked about Gaddafi's murder, she said, "We came, we saw, he died." Now, I mean, I always say I like my feminists murder-free, and I don't think that's too much to ask. You know, Hillary Clinton has never put forward policies or visions that deal with poor women, with black, brown, Latinx women in her country. So I don't buy the argument that I'm supposed to like her just because she's facing off against Donald Trump. I don't like her. I find her deeply problematic. And Chimamanda interviewed her in a way that I just felt hurt by. She doesn't ask her anything about power. She doesn't ask her anything about violence and war. She doesn't ask her anything about how she sleeps at night. She asks her things like, I mean, I don't even remember. She says at one point that she wants to call her auntie, that in her head she calls her auntie. You know, that it's kind of awful. It's shockingly bad. And I remember thinking, if someone else had done that, we'll be nice. But if, like, literally any other writer had done that to Hillary Clinton, I would have been like, okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, a woman writer from Nigeria, a woman who's tackled race, You know, Hillary Clinton's husband, you know, was one of the great incarcerators of American presidents as far as they go. Wasn't it Bill Clinton that put in the three strikes? So, you know, Bill Clinton was the one who made it three strikes and you go to jail for life in America. And that's disproportionately non-white people who suffer from that. How could Chimamanda not ask her that? And, you know, some people said, well, you know, that wasn't her, that was her husband. Well, she was a part of her husband's government. She's a politician. She then becomes answerable to the people. And I wrote about that because I think the role of artists is never to celebrate power. You might like someone on a personal level. You might be friends with someone. That's great. Don't interview them for Penn, you know? Go to their home for dinner. I think that's okay.
Call them auntie at home,
you know? and the story that was important for me to share in that piece was under Ziaul-Haq's dictatorship, which was a brutal time. And one of the things he did was that he censored not just journalism, but life and culture in Pakistan. So Pakistani newspapers had to go through twice daily censorship checks at this time. And anything the junta didn't like, they just crossed out. And at some point, broadsheets got really sick of coming up with copy to fill these blank spaces. So they started going to print with just empty spaces in the newspaper. So you'd open up Pakistani newspapers in the 80s, and it would just be like one story and then just a sea of whiteness. And the dictatorship then made it against the law to go to print with empty spots in the paper. So they started to print pictures of donkeys in those spots. So you know, this was also a time when that's why journalists were flogged in public, because they resisted. And poets went into exile. So there's a very famous Pakistani poet called Fez, Ahmed Fez. And he wrote beautiful verse against the dictatorship. He had to leave the country for it. And there's a singer called, she was called Iqbal Banu. And after Fez had been sent into exile, Iqbal Banu stood in on a stage in Lahore and sang his poetry. And they ruined her life. She could never perform again. She was not allowed to be on TV. She was not allowed to give concerts. But she did that. And that's the role of writers, to me, is to celebrate resistance, not to celebrate power.
Did you want to say anything about that, Mona?
About Chimamanda? No, I think Fatima covered that beautifully.
She did.
Yes.
In fact, in that same piece you wrote, for many writers in the non-Western world, this is what resistance means, to speak when words are met with lethal blows.
Yeah, I find it kind of cringy, you know, when Donald Trump was elected, and I heard otherwise sort of reasonable sounding women say things like, oh, you know, I'm part of the resistance now. And it's like, you know, you went to a protest, you're not being shot in a forest. And in places like Egypt, in places like Saudi Arabia, in places like Pakistan, resistance is not you wear a hat and you go out for 2 hours, you know, according to a weekend afternoon to go to a protest. It means literally you pay with your body. It means you pay with your life.
I do think that raises a question for an Australian audience. And I would be interested when you get up to speak, if anyone will ask this question, about what resistance does look like in a place where it seems as though everything is fine, when at a superficial level, you don't have to necessarily pay with your body. So I think there are real questions about depth.
I would love to add to that, because Fatima covered Chimamanda beautifully, and I loved that essay that you wrote, Fatima. I was discussing with Sasonke yesterday. One of the things that I brought up during this now infamous Q&A episode, and I mentioned again, you know, whenever I've been interviewed by your media, is what your current prime minister is doing. Because he's like a mini Trump, he's a wannabe Trump, and Trump himself is a wannabe dictator who calls the dictator of my country of birth, Egypt, my favorite dictator. So you've got this club of dictators around the world, and your prime minister here is seriously discussing banning boycotts. You had raids on the media last year. So as I said on Q&A, and I keep repeating, this is supposed to be a democracy. And democracies don't go, you know, in this kind of neat line linearly. You know, I'm told by my Australian friends in the 70s, this country was quite different. So you can think that you're quite a progressive country in some issues, huh? But not in indigenous issues and racism. And then you're walking along in your nice progressive path, and then you get all of your political parties being anti-immigration, left, right, center, upside down. That's outrageous. You have a prime minister now who is a Christian evangelical and a white supremacist who wants to ban boycotts and protests at a time when people from my parts of the world are risking their lives. Lebanon now has risen up. Sudan most recently, Algeria, Iraq. So ask yourself, what does it mean to live in one of the richest countries in the world where you have a white supremacist Christian evangelical prime minister who is appealing to a certain demographic in your country who wants to ban boycotts and protests? But more importantly, ask yourself, what are you doing about this?
So we've talked about courage, and we've talked about when, how we choose to speak. I suppose there's a real question about what speaking means when there are other forms of action. So why speak, and is it a question of speaking versus doing? And I ask that question, you know. Yeah, is speaking a form of doing? Yeah. You know what I'm trying to say.
Well, I mean, you can do both. I mean, there is both. I mean, I mentioned how central to my not being obedient anymore, being sexually assaulted during Hajj was. And I'm a very personal writer. I include a lot of, more recently, I've included more and more of the me and my personal life. So I use the words, but I also use the actions. And one of the actions was joining the revolution in Egypt later that year, because the revolution isn't just the 18 days, and having my arms broken by Egyptian riot police and being sexually assaulted. My action there, I mean, it's not about the fighting back, but what did I do there? It was to expose what the regime did to me on every media known to humanity, because I have that platform. But it was also a few years later that I've kind of brought all of this full circle, and it's again one of the reasons that I speak as I do now about justifiable violence by women against men's unjustifiable violence. And that last year at a club in Montreal, Canada, when I was 50 years old, definitely not in hijab, but in a tank top and jeans, a man sexually assaulted me and I tracked him down and he fell when I tugged at his shirt and I sat on him in this club and I punched him about 12 times. I punched and I punched and I punched. And every time I punched him, I said to him, don't you ever fucking touch a woman like that again. And I beat the fuck out of this guy. I really did. And it was glorious, glorious. So that is action that I demand the right to have. And that's why I asked on Q&A, how many rapists must we kill until men stop raping us? And the men got more upset about my question than the actual rape that happens to women every day. Ask yourself what that means.
Yeah, yeah.
Fatima, is writing doing?
I think so. I think writing is doing. I think if writing is a freer space, then that can be more powerful than the doing. But I agree with Mona. I think there's both. I don't think you have to choose one or the other. I mean, I don't know if you find this as well, Mona, but I know we both do a lot of these talks and you travel a lot and we talk about these ideas. And I have to say, I've been to more talks where women talk about these things than I have seen women defend each other.
Mm.
I mean, I think that's something that gets left out of these feminist conversations because we're all supposed to be, you know, positive and sharing. But I don't really see a lot of women defending each other. You know, you end up being on stages where somebody will be unfairly treated, and I haven't really seen women stand up to defend each other.
Well, I think, and it has to do with power, Fatima, which is why, yeah, I'm so glad that you placed what you wrote about Chimamanda in power, because there are some women who will accept crumbs from patriarchy for a little amount of power. They're the foot soldiers of patriarchy. They're the women who want to vote for a woman simply because she's a woman. Is she a woman who's dismantling patriarchy or a woman upholding patriarchy? And depending on where you live, so here and in the US, it would be a woman who's upholding whiteness, a woman for whom race trumps her gender, a woman like, I think it's some media personality who wants climate extremists to be treated like speed bumps. So when a white woman openly incites violence against people in this country, nothing happens to her. But when a woman of color a panel of women and one non-binary indigenous person talks about women's right to defend ourselves, all hell breaks loose because the men are upset. Well, fuck the men.
Yeah. But even, I mean, you weren't here, Mona, yesterday, but Raquel spoke about being at the Women's March in D.C. and having her mic cut. You know, and she's a black woman, a trans woman.
Yes.
And her mic is cut, and you know why? So that celebrities or more, you know, these sort of famous women can speak. And I'm kind of amazed that, like, at a women's march, no other woman said, hold on, yes, we want to hear her.
And you know, at the end of that march, one of the things that astounded me, having been subject to police brutality and seeing police brutality in the United States, all these women were going, white women, of course, posting on Twitter, you know, these happy pictures with the police and how the police were great today and the police, you know, opened the streets to us today. And they did not stop for a second. There was no self-reflection. Why were the police so nice to you, white ladies of America, in your pink pussy hats? Because you're white women, right? There's no self-reflection. And so it's this proximity to whiteness that gives these women power. And they accept the crumbs from that whiteness. And I'm like, fuck your crumbs. I don't want your crumbs. I want the entire cake. I don't even want your cake. I want my own cake. I'm an anarchist. I don't want your fucking cake.
But, you know, it also can be not just whiteness. So one of the examples that I always think is really telling is that in a Pakistani election, one of the ways in which rigging is really easily accomplished, and there's many ways, of course, but one of the easiest ways to rig an election in Pakistan, in a polling booth, is through women. And it comes from this, like, so we, in Pakistan, to have a national identity card, which you need to have a bank account, which you need to vote, which you need to buy a plane ticket, is not a right, it's a privilege. So you're not just given it at 18, you have to pay for it. And you've got to expend time and energy to go to the national database office, pay for it, answer the questions, go home, go back, pick it up. So who gets left out of that? I mean, A, it's largely women, and it's largely the poor. But what a political party will do come election time is, because of a law that another dictator, General Musharraf, put in, a woman doesn't have to show her face on her identity card, so she can wear a full face cover and is not required to remove it. So when you turn up at a polling booth and you hand over a card with literally no face on it, nobody can ask you to show your face. So in a women's polling booth, there'll be loads of women. And you can only tell from the shoes, because they won't change their shoes. So if you see the same pair of shoes come back, that's women. You can't, I mean, it's very hard to talk about that.
Well, we had women dancing for Sisi in Egypt, and this is the man who used to be head of military intelligence. When the Egyptian military subjected women revolutionaries to sexual assault via so-called virginity test, and he was the head of military intelligence when military intelligence detained me, blindfolded me, and interrogated me with two broken arms after the police had sexually assaulted me. And they had women dancing for Sisi. And they're and that's why I'm saying, depending on where you are, that's the power, because power in Egypt is the military. In the US, it's the white blonde women who are at the front of every Trump rally, right? The Trump blonde women, and the women who wear Grab This Pussy t-shirts. So according to where you are, it's the women who recognize where power from that supremacy at play is, and they accept, just like, it's unbelievable.
That's right. That there's nothing essential about power in any given framework, right? What people do is that they adhere to whoever has the most power, and you attach the part of yourself that is proximate to power, and that blinds you to other people's lack of power, right?
And also, women, I think, are not inherently...
No, good. Yeah. Oh, I wish.
No, yeah.
Which has to be said, I feel.
Of course. Yeah. It's insulting us to think that we're like the soft, gentle, gentler sex.
Yeah.
It's right. Like, no, because I will fucking beat you up if you assault me. But at the same time, it's also, it's curbing our humanity, isn't it?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It's about what you do with power, and are you dismantling... Because, you know, one of the things that comes up again and again about feminism, it's like, what is your feminism aiming to do? Is it aiming to just make your individual life a good life? Because if in that case, so-called mainstream white feminism, whatever you want to call it, or is it something that is meant to dismantle all the systems of oppression that hurt so many other people? That's why I say patriarchy is not about men. Patriarchy is about privileging male dominance. So what are we doing about poverty? What are we capitalism, racism, homophobia, transphobia, ageism, ableism, and women? our foot soldiers, they can be for all of those if they benefit. So when you fight, you're not just fighting for your individual life or you, Sasonke. We're fighting to dismantle those systems of power and oppressions that are meant to disrupt and to just destroy these injustices. I mean, that's feminism for me.
That's right. So, which was my last question that I was going to ask before opening it up, which is, what is courage for? So what do you use your voice in service of? And both of you have new books. And both of you have chosen to frame your voices in particularly different ways. And Fatima, I'm interested in this whole idea of soft power and sort of this emerged in many ways, Asian middle class, and this idea of using culture as power.
Yeah, I mean, New Kings of the World is really comes out of a feeling that I've had just growing up and living in the global south, which is that the West is not the center of the world. I mean, it might be the center of the world if you live in the West, but that's an illusion, that's a fantasy. We don't live in a unipolar world. We really do live in a world with 100 centers, with millions of centers. And as an Asian person, I was really fed up about always being relegated to this peripheral zone, always being spoken down to, always being instructed in the ways of not just culture, but everything. And I think part of what power does is power is so manipulative and it's so insidious that it finds different avenues through which to put forth its messages. It doesn't just operate through force or through violence. It does it through culture too. So, you know, when you're watching films, you're being pumped full of politically coded messages. Whether it's a film like Rambo or Rocky or, you know, those kind of films were weapons of American power at the time. You know, gone are the days when the Russians, the Soviets used to be the bad guys. They may come back, I don't know, but now they're all brown people. They're all Muslims.
It's always a Muslim terrorist.
It's always a Muslim terrorist, you know. And I really can't watch those films anymore.
And so what is there to watch instead? There's nothing else out there.
There's millions and millions and millions of things to watch if you don't want to watch that. If you don't want to watch, you know, there's a film called American Sniper, which I suggest you never watch. but if you have already seen it, then you know that it's a film romanticizing a literal American sniper who is in Iraq literally sniping Iraqi people in an unjust war and occupation. And there's this horrific scene where the sniper, who's played by Bradley Cooper, is on a rooftop, you know, just waiting, I guess. And a little boy comes around the corner, and, you know, as Iraqi boys often do, he's carrying a rocket launcher on his shoulder, looking for someone to shoot. And the American sniper character...
As 10-year-old Iraqi boys do.
The American sniper character, who, by the way, wrote a book in which he called Arabs barbarians and admitted that he enjoyed killing Arabs, that there was something pleasurable about killing an Arab, is now whitewashed in this film. And so he's sitting there looking at this child and he's almost crying, you know, like, oh, don't do it, son, like, put it down. He doesn't want to kill him, but he has to. You know, this is a film that won an Oscar.
Unfucking believable.
You know what I mean? It's and that's not an exception.
Yeah.
That's Hollywood. And so if you don't want to watch that, you've got plenty of options, which is not to say that anyone else is more innocent. I mean, clearly, any look at Bollywood today will tell you that there's nothing innocent about Bollywood. But there are other options, and I think we have the right to them.
That's right. Absolutely. Thanks, Fatima.
So one of the things I do in my book is talk about those other names and places and people you should know, because the West, especially the United States, because I live there and I'm a dual citizen, is not the center of the universe. So I'll talk about three of them very briefly. One of them is a hero of mine, the Ugandan feminist, Dr. Stella Nyanzi. I mentioned her on Q&A the other night, so it's ironic that they pulled and censored an episode where I mention a woman who's currently in prison because she offended the dictator of her country. And she is a proponent of radical rudeness. This is why one of the reasons I swear, I use profanity politically, very consciously and very intentionally. And radical rudeness came about in Uganda in the 1940s when anti-colonial activists refused to abide by the rules of decorum and respectability by the white Christian Victorians and prudes sent over from the UK to colonize their country. So she is intentionally profane, radically rude, and she's in prison for offending the dictator of her country. I also mention two women in India who finally were able to enter a Hindu temple in Kerala after women in India between the age of 10 to 50, because they're called menstruating ages, were banned. And this is also a reminder that this menstruation taboo is global, universal, belongs to every religion, belongs to every cultural group out there. And those two women made history in India in 2000, at the beginning of this year, and I connect it to Amina Wadood, who's an Islamic feminist. I'm not an Islamic feminist, but Amina is a good friend of mine and a mentor. And Amina Wadood led us in New York City in 2005 in a mixed gender prayer in which a woman led women and men praying behind her. 2005, I prayed without my headscarf, I prayed next to a man, and I prayed on my period, triple whammy, fuck you, patriarchy. I also mentioned, and this I will wrap it up with this, Argentinians who were on the streets in their country as their Senate was debating decriminalizing abortion. Now, when I talk about women and girls in the title of my book, it's just to make it neat. I'm not just talking about women and girls. I'm talking about those of us who have no safety within patriarchy. So women, girls, non-binary people, gender diverse people. And when I say vaginas and pussies and cunts, I don't just mean women, because vaginas, pussies and cunts don't just sit in female cis bodies. There are also trans women who are very much part of my discussion, and I talk about gender diverse people. And the Argentinians were a beautiful illustration of that, because there's a group of activists there, part of the Ni Una Menos, Not One More movement, that is across the continent now, in Central and South America, that has risen up against violence against women and girls and gender diverse people. And they were outside the Argentinian Senate, and they issued this beautiful statement that I quote and I end my book with, in which they say, "We, feminists, women and gender diverse people, we are out here because we all know how common abortion is, even though it kills so many women, cis women today. Regardless of what happens in the Senate," and they ended up not decriminalizing abortion, we will come back every day and we will not be burnt, because this time the fire is ours. I love that. This time the fire is ours. So take that fire and recognize that it does not sit in one place of the world. It is ours around the world to burn the patriarchy down with.
We have 7 minutes for questions. So if anyone wants to ask a question, please get up. There's ushers waiting. Yes.
Hi, I'm a little bit nervous to ask this, because you guys are so sort of at the end of the radical spectrum in terms of feminism. But I feel like I've been thinking this all day yesterday and today as well, and I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one in the audience, so I'm kind of taking one for the team, I think, a little bit. So for the first 35 years of my life, I lived in a space of white privilege, and it was only when I changed jobs 15 years ago and had a lot more exposure to people whose lives were not like mine, both in Australia and then internationally, that I started on a journey of really understanding how much privilege I had and trying to use that to help change the world. But I've also done it from the perspective a little bit of feeling that you need to be in the belly of the beast to give it indigestion. So I'm just wondering, do you see there's a spectrum of how to be a good feminist, where sometimes it's about using your connections to power and your whiteness to get in the space where you can change people's minds in one way, and at the other end of the spectrum, where you are, Mona, where it's all about being radical and rude and making a stand and being very clear what's okay and what's not okay?
Very quickly, because there might be other questions, I tell everyone, practice what I call feminism in 3D, which is defy, disobey and disrupt. Find ways every day to defy, disobey, and disrupt the patriarchy. But I'm really glad that you asked this question about your white privilege, because I have so many events in which white women stand up and just want to make it about them and urge me not to otherize them. And I don't know what the fuck otherizing white women means, because it's like the other way around. But I urge you to have this conversation with other white women and help them defy, disobey, and disrupt in the ways that you've learned. Within, have these discussions with other white women, because I did not come out of my mother's womb screaming, fuck the patriarchy. I had to work up. This is why I said I was so polite and obedient when I was much younger. But talk to other white women about the insidious and often invisible ways in which your whiteness protects you from so much that it does not protect any of us and so many other people. And it's not just about being white, it's also about being white and working class, because you can be white and be working class and not have the privilege that you would have to be here in this hall with us. So talk about other white people, about the invisible privileges that you don't see, and find ways to defy, disobey, and disrupt them.
I would just say, I mean, I think it's completely unfair, this idea, which I always see as a really Western idea, to change the world. I think, you know, how exhausting is that if all of us have to go around changing the world?
And also arrogant.
And arrogant, exactly. So I would take the very Asian approach, which is that forget the world. I think the work we have to do is our own. And if you're doing that work with yourself, then you're doing the right work. If it extends beyond you, that's wonderful. If it doesn't, I don't think that lessens the work you're doing.
Absolutely. And radical has many forms, right? So I think the use of the term radical is often it's a disempowering word. Because I think to defy, to disobey, to disrupt takes many, many forms. And so if you're challenging, then you are doing the work. And the work of naming whiteness as an enemy, whiteness, not white people, whiteness, is really important for understanding how we enter to challenge it. But it does not mean that this is an attack on white people, that white women are the enemy. We must work in coalition with one another, but we can't do that without naming the things that are problematic. Yeah, so you're doing the work. I see another question.
You spoke about sort of Scott Morrison and the banning boycotts earlier. What do you think sort of needs to be done to sort of like fight against sort of like state-sanctioned violence and unjust laws and things like that?
I think I can't see you, so I'm sorry if I'm not looking directly at you. You're over there somewhere. Okay, because the light is right there in my eyes. Thank you for wanting to focus on that. I think that you need to work on multiple levels, because like Sasanke said, defying, disobeying, and disrupting can mean many things. So insist on your right to protest, insist on your right to freedom of assembly and freedom of expression. Vote wisely in the next elections. Make alliances with other activists, what they call the so-called climate extremists, which are basically climate activists. Find out how you can help them. Go out there and be involved. Write to your local representatives, but that's not even enough, but just take some kind of action that allows Scott Morrison, or insists that Scott Morrison and those in power know that you do not agree, that you are truly resisting, in the true meaning of the word resist. So protest, vote, get out there and work with other people, make alliances, find the ways that you can be strong, and find out those who he particularly targets and ask them how they need your help. Because sometimes there's someone who's already working on these things before you come along, and they want you to amplify their voice. So there are many, many ways. Just find out who is working on these things, go on there and find out ways to amplify and to expand the stage for them very quickly.
This is a question for everyone. You talked about dismantling systemic oppression. Do you think that should be done in an intersectional way, or should you just target one particular power structure?
Oh, we hate intersectionality up here.
it can only be done through intersectionality. There's no other way.
Yeah, absolutely. Intersectional or nothing. We have 23 seconds, and so I'm not going to take any more questions.
Can I do something very unusual? And I hope that you'll all bear with me here, because, you know, it's been quite a week. I did this in Nigeria about 2 weeks ago, and in Lagos, and I would love to do it here in Melbourne in your town hall. Could we all please stand up, and on the count of three, you know what I'm going to ask you to do. Could you please stand up?
What are we doing? I don't actually know.
Oh, okay, got it.
If you have phones, get your phones out and take this, because I want you to remember this moment.
But how can you face this way so you can all see yourselves?
Well, film yourselves.
Yeah.
All right, ready? All right, get ready. Get ready. Phones out, people.
Aren't Melbourne filming this? They can...
And they will film each other, and I'm sure that the broadside is filming it. Are you ready? Yeah. One, two, three, five. Thank you.
That would be a wonderful place to close, but I wanted to say thank you. Did you want to? I wanted to say thank you to our incredible Auslan translators. Thank you very much. True intersectionality means making what seems invisible, visible. Nothing and no one is invisible. It's just that we're not looking at them. So if there is anything I want us to take away from this conversation, it's this idea that deepening the conversation, speaking out, is always about thinking more deeply about the questions that confront us. It is about insisting that people who are tucked away through extra legal means, who are in Nauru and Manus Island, are not invisible. It is about insisting. Insisting that when Hillary Clinton wears a pantsuit that we love, what her actions have been as Secretary of State are not invisible. It is about insisting that when ScoMo makes statements that we find unacceptable and says that he speaks for the quiet Australians, we insist too that we will be loud. Thank you very much. Necessary Truths.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Center podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercenter.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.